Morning. Well, we have an awesome thing to do this morning. That's to consider the crucifixion, the narrative in the Gospel of Matthew. Question, why was Jesus crucified? There were human reasons and there were divine reasons. A few weeks ago, Dan Westman spelled out for us the human reasons, but let me reiterate those for us here this morning. First of all, Jesus did not go along with a nationalist agenda. That is the Jewish nationalist agenda. He wasn't in favor of the revolution against Rome. Rome was the oppressing power of the day, ruled over Palestine, ruled over the Jews. Most Jews probably wanted their Messiah to come when he came and to overthrow Rome. Not all, but most wanted that. Certainly the Pharisees would be in that category. Certain leaders of the Jews would be in that category, wanting the overthrow of Rome. But Jesus didn't go along with that. In fact, he repudiated that agenda. So he troubled the nationalists. On the other hand, among the Jews, there were those who collaborated with Roman rule, such as the Sadducees. They arranged for themselves a rather comfortable life for themselves between the Romans and the Jewish populace. They were more aristocratic, and they enjoyed some measure of power under Roman rule. They were collaborators with Rome. But what Jesus did is he stirred up the masses, and that upset the collaborators as well. That upset the Sadducees as well, because the last thing you want, if you enjoy some measure of power, is a crowd that is stirred up. So as they say, politics makes strange bedfellows, and the Sadducees and the Pharisees, those people who are on the left and the right, however you define left and right in those days, they combine and they determine that Jesus must be overthrown, he must be done away with, he must be executed. However, they do not have the authority under Roman rule to carry out such executions, so what they have to do is convince the Romans, i.e. Pilate, the Roman governor, that Jesus is a threat. And so what they do is then they take Jesus to Pilate. He doesn't think Jesus is a threat. However, they're able to paint Pilate into a corner so that finally he agrees that Jesus must be crucified. So Pilate then hands Jesus over to the Roman soldiers and they carry forth the execution. So those are the human reasons. But there are divine reasons as well, because as Jesus is being crucified, the whole human drama of redemption is reaching its climax. And we want to pay attention today to that divine drama that is really unfolding before us in the Gospel of Matthew. Our last song begins this way, "When I Survey the Wondrous Cross." That's what we're going to do this morning. We're not going to do it in song. We're going to do it with the Gospel of narrative, with the Gospel of Matthew. We're going to join the narrative, and we're going to survey the wondrous cross and see what we can see. We want to stay alert to what's going on here. We actually want to listen as well, for there's very fascinating dialogue that is pregnant with meaning. We want to see. We want to hear. And if we can do that, if we can listen to this higher drama, I'm convinced that this story can open up new avenues in our hearts. It is an absolutely awesome narrative, especially when you consider the entire narrative as a whole, that is the Gospel of Matthew, and also the entire biblical narrative as a whole. It all comes down to this. This is the climax. Everything in the biblical story, everything in the Gospel of Matthew is leading to this moment. Indeed, we should pay attention. The narrative is found on page 834 in your pew Bibles. We are in the Gospel of Matthew, chapter 27. Pilate, the Roman governor, has just handed Jesus over to be crucified, and the Roman soldiers have been making sport of him. We pick up the story, Matthew chapter 27, verse 33. "And when they came to a place called Golgotha, which means place of a skull, they offered him wine to drink mixed with gall. But when he tasted it, he would not drink it. And when they had crucified him, they divided his garments among them by casting lots. Then they sat down and kept watch over him there. And over his head they put the charge against him, which read, 'This is Jesus, the King of the Jews.'" So the Roman soldiers lead him out, and they crucify him. They lead him to this place called Golgotha, which translated means place of a skull. Now, Matthew doesn't give us any more details about this place than that. Suffice it to say, place of a skull does not sound like the kind of place you'd go for a picnic. They give Jesus this wine gall mixture. This evidently is to torment him. Here, have a drink. Oh, maybe I'd like a drink. Oh, it's mixed with gall. It's bitter. They are trying to torture him. Jesus refuses. The Roman soldiers on the scene think that Jesus is somewhat of a joke, and they're thinking, how can we profit from this? Maybe some of his clothing. Maybe we can have a few scraps of his clothing. So they cast lots. Tragically, that's how they think that they can profit from the crucifixion of Jesus, simply by getting a few scraps of clothing. And of course, if you move forward in the whole biblical narrative, you come to the book of Galatians, and Paul says that those who believe in Christ are clothed with Christ. Tragically, some people don't recognize how they can profit actually from the crucifixion of Jesus. Maybe a few scraps of clothing is all they want when salvation is offered to them. Well, after they have their fun, they sit down and watch. This is what Roman soldiers on the scene of a crucifixion were supposed to do, by the way. They were supposed to watch. So after the fun is over with, they sit down and they watch. They watch what's unfolding before them, and they're going to watch Jesus die. And by the time we get to the end of the narrative, they're going to come up with a very interesting conclusion in view of what they see. The charge against Jesus is that he is King of the Jews. This is the charge that the Romans leveled against him. And this functions both as a joke and a deterrent. Here is Jesus, the would-be King of the Jews, this forlorn figure being crucified, being crushed under the boot of Roman power. And this gives the opportunity for the Roman soldiers to laugh. The Jews, you know, they're going to put forth a king. It's something like this that they put forth. The King of the Jews. It's a joke. And of course, they're thinking to themselves, this is the best that they can do. This is the best that the Jews can do, is put forth this character as a king. It's also a deterrent that says in no uncertain terms, if you take issue with our right to rule, what we are going to do is we are going to give you a little demonstration of our authority and put you on one of our crosses. These crosses were all over the place. And the Romans crucified anyone who took issue with their right to rule. And the Romans are saying, by these crosses, don't mess with us. We're in charge here, and you're not. The irony, of course, is that Jesus is the King of the Jews. He's not only the King of the Jews, he's also the King of the whole world. And how is he bringing in the kingdom? In the most astounding of ways, by submitting to a brutal, shameful death. Now we transition to the Jews on the scene. What do they see? What do they do? Verse 38. Then two robbers were crucified with him, one on the right and one on the left. And those who passed by derided him, wagging their heads and saying, "You who would destroy the temple and rebuild it in 3 days, save yourself. If you are the Son of God, come down from the cross." So also the chief priests with the scribes and elders mocked him, saying, "He saved others, he cannot save himself. He is the King of Israel. Let him come down now from the cross, and we will believe in him. He trusts in God. Let God deliver him now if he desires him. For he said, 'I am the Son of God.'" And the robbers who were crucified with him also reviled him in the same way. Two robbers are crucified, one on the right and one on the left. And by the way, these aren't robbers, these are insurrectionists. These are Jewish brigands. They want to revolt against Rome, and this is why they end up on these particular crosses. Now, you may remember, if you have read the Gospels before, if you have read the Gospel of Matthew before, that two of Jesus' disciples, James and John, made this request. They make the request in the Gospel of Mark, in the Gospel of Matthew. It's their mother who puts them forward. And the request is this. When James and John, when Jesus comes into his kingdom, James and John want to be with Jesus. They want to reign with him. One on the right and one on the left. And now, as Jesus is coming into his kingdom in the most astounding of ways, where are James and John? They want no part of this kingdom, at least at this point. And when Jesus looks to his right and to his left, where he might expect to see two disciples, two friends, he sees two angry brigands. One of which, of course, has a change of heart. We see that in the Gospel of Luke. The people on the scene here have a problem with this title, Son of God. What does that mean? What does it mean to be the Son of God? It goes back to David and the other kings of Israel. They were called sons of God. Therefore, ultimately, there was one who was expected, who was going to be the final, ultimate king, who was going to be the Son of God, and they began to call this individual the Messiah. So Son of God means king. It means Messiah. And in the Jewish mindset, at least in the nationalist mindset, if you were the Messiah, if you were the Son of God, the last place we would expect to find you is to be hanging on one of these Roman crosses. The Messiah, when he came, the Son of God, when he came, would be expected to uproot these bloody crosses that have been polluting our land, uproot these bloody Roman crosses and get rid of them. Not die on one of them. For Jesus to be called the Son of God and to die on a Roman cross, that's unbelievable. We couldn't even think about that. They think it's an absolute joke. You see, Jesus' problem wasn't so much with Rome. He didn't see Rome as the evil empire. Oh, of course, Rome was evil. But the real problem that Jesus had was not with Rome, but with Israel. Israel was supposed to be the light to the nations, but Israel has become just as pagan as the Romans. So these Jews on the scene find in Jesus an outlet for their bitter frustrations. So many today are looking for an outlet for their bitter frustrations. They're so disappointed. They're so frustrated. They had such hopes for life, and it's not working out. Somebody must be to blame. You can go to certain websites, certain blogs. They're angry people who are finding outlets for their bitter frustrations. That's what these people are doing. Jesus is an outlet. He's a disappointment to them. They say to him, if you are the Son of God, come down from the cross. If you really are the Messiah, if you really are the one who was to come, the one who we have been pinning all our hopes on, then come down from the cross. Prove yourself. Come down from the cross and do what you're supposed to do. Do what the Messiah is supposed to do. Lead us into victory over Rome. To them, of course, it is a joke, but to Jesus, it is as real as the nails in his hands. We read in Matthew chapter 26, verse 53, in Gethsemane, when they came for Jesus, he said that he could call on the Father, and the Father could send more than 12 legions of angels. Jesus could have put more than 12 legions of angels at his disposal. He did not have to stay on the cross. He could have come down from the cross. If you are the Son of God, come down from the cross. It is not the first time that Jesus has heard such words. In the wilderness, right at the beginning, the evil one tempted him. Matthew chapter 4, verse 3. And the tempter came and said to him, "If you are the Son of God, command these stones to become loaves of bread." Matthew chapter 4, verses 5 and 6. The devil took him to the holy city and set him on a pinnacle of the temple and said to him, "If you are the Son of God, throw yourself down." What was the evil one trying to do back then? He was trying to get Jesus, the Son of God, to fulfill his vocation in an expected way and to avoid the chaos of the cross. But the evil one has not been able to do that. So finally, when Jesus goes to the cross, the evil one hits him with everything he's got at his weakest possible moment, physically, emotionally, spiritually, everything. Now the evil one has him. "If you are the Son of God, come down from the cross." And we can imagine the evil one putting those words into the bystanders on the scene. So that Jesus hears the voice of Satan one more time. What's it like when you hear that awful voice? That awful voice that challenges something that you consider central to your identity. That awful voice, it comes from within sometimes, sometimes it comes from without. It goes something like this: "You're not much of a man, are you? You're not much of a woman, are you? You're not much of a mother, are you? You're not much of a father, are you? You're not much of a teacher, are you? You're not much of an engineer, are you? You're not much of a doctor, not much of a lawyer, are you?" When you hear the voice, it demands that you prove it wrong. Jesus hears the voice. It goes to someplace deep within him. The most central title for Jesus was that of Son of God. It's who he was, deep in his being. It was central to his identity and to his vocation. And he hears that voice. It demands that he prove it wrong. There's a parallel here with the legend of Odysseus, written by Homer, probably the second work of literature in the Western world. Odysseus, you may remember the story, is returning from the Trojan War. He has to sail through all sorts of dangers, and one of the places he has to sail past is the island of the Sirens. And the Sirens sing their beautiful, irresistible voice. And Odysseus knows that all men who hear that voice cannot resist it. And all who hear that voice end up dead on the shore. So what does Odysseus do in Homer's The Odyssey? He has all of his men plug up their ears with wax so they can't hear. But he wants to hear. So he orders them to lash him to the mast. And he also orders them, if the Sirens are singing their song and they see him squirming to get free, or if he commands them to loosen him, his command is, "Just tie me tighter. Just tie me tighter." So sure enough, they sail by the island of the Sirens, and the Sirens sing their song of intense beauty and intense power. And when Odysseus hears it, he can't resist. It goes deep into his being, and he's squirming and he's struggling to get free. But because he has already ordered his men, they simply tie him tighter, and all of them sail to safety. Now think about this. Jesus has no men to give orders to. Everything has to come from within. All that resistance has to come from within. He hears the song of the Sirens, that irresistible song. It goes into some deep place within him, and somehow he doesn't come down from the cross. So we ask ourselves, what keeps him there? Why does he stay on the cross? Answer number one, he stays for these people who are abusing him. "Come down, build the temple." He knows if he comes down and builds a temple, that's nothing. What is he supposed to do? Come down and be what they expect him to be? He knows that if he does that, There's nothing. There's nothing for them. So he hears in their voice not only the temptation and the taunt, but he also hears in their voice, they need him to stay there. So he stays even for those who are taunting him and mocking him. Answer number one, he stays for them. Answer number two, he stays for us. He could have come down from the cross, but he stays for us. When you are sinned against, you want to sin against someone else, right? The person who has hurt you. If you're hurt, you want to hurt in return. If you're reviled, you revile in return. First Peter chapter 2, verse 23. When he, that is Jesus, was reviled, he did not revile in return. When he suffered, he did not threaten, but continued entrusting himself to him who judges justly. All this evil is thrown on Jesus, and we know theologically all the evil of all history is thrown onto Jesus. And instead of responding, instead of fighting back, all this evil dissolves into the purity of his being. The cross in its day was a symbol of oppression and power and brutality for God's people. Today, followers of Jesus have landscaped the world with crosses as symbols of God's love. Matthew 27, verse 45. Now from the sixth hour there was darkness over all the land until the ninth hour. And about the ninth hour, Jesus cried out with a loud voice, saying, Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani, that is, my God, why have you forsaken me? And some of the bystanders, hearing it, said, this man is calling Elijah. And one of them at once ran and took a sponge, filled it with sour wine, and put it on a reed and gave it to him to drink. But the others said, wait, let us see whether Elijah will come to save him. And Jesus cried out again with a loud voice, and yielded up his spirit. Jesus cries, my God, why have you forsaken me? Let's do a little work and go backwards in the biblical story. Deuteronomy chapter 31, verse 6. This is Moses speaking to Israel. He will not leave you or forsake you. This is the Lord speaking to Joshua. Joshua chapter 1, verse 5. Just as I was with Moses, so I will be with you. I will not leave you or forsake you. God's not going to forsake Israel. God's not going to forsake Joshua. And here we have Jesus, who is Israel all by himself. He is the new Joshua, the new Moses, the new Abraham, the new David, the new everything. He has never wavered once. He has remained completely faithful to God. He has been strong and courageous throughout. And now he comes to this place and he says, my God, why have you forsaken me? Why? Now Jesus understood that it was going to end this way. He told his disciples multiple times, this is going to happen. They're going to hand me over to the Romans. The Romans are going to crucify me. He knew that it was going to lead to this. But finally, when he gets to this place, when he gets to this God-forsaken place, he asks, why? He didn't know it was going to be like this. It looks like the Father has had to abandon him for just a moment because he's taken on the sins of the world, and he didn't know it was going to be like this. Now, we could spend 1,000 sermons trying to understand the nature of this cry, but let me just make one observation. Jesus obviously is channeling David from Psalm 22, verse 1. It's a psalm of lament. David cried out, my God, why have you forsaken me? Now Jesus cries out, my God, why have you forsaken me? And Jesus is going to some deep place. It's coming from a deep place within him, and he gives voice to the deepest cry of the human heart. In every age, in every generation, the cry goes up, God, why have you forsaken me? God, if you exist, why all this? God, if you are all-powerful and all-loving, why all this? God, my God, if you are all-powerful and all-loving, why does some gunman walk into my school and gun down my child? My God, why have you forsaken me? That's the human cry. And Jesus gives voice to that and gives us permission to articulate our own lament. This is worship, my friends. To be able to cry out authentically to God and say, my God, why have you forsaken me? Instead of walking away from him, simply to cry out to him, that's worship. Jesus gives voice to the deepest cry of the human heart. But the Jews on the scene misunderstand him. They think that he is calling out for Elijah. You could understand why they would misunderstand this. Because the words that Jesus used were in Aramaic. He spoke probably mostly, if not entirely, in Aramaic. That would be the Jewish dialect of the day. And the gospel writers, what they do is they translate what Jesus has said into Greek, and then our translators translate that into English for us. But on occasion, they leave Jesus' words untranslated, and he cries out, Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani. Eli sounds like Elijah. So they think he's calling out for Elijah. Now, the expectation was, based on the last chapter of Malachi and some other texts, the Jewish expectation was that Elijah was going to come again and quite possibly do some sort of deliverance or at least prepare the way for deliverance. So they think that Jesus is calling out for Elijah. But Jesus has already identified the new Elijah. He says, John the Baptist, who has come, he is the new Elijah. He takes on the role of Elijah in order to prepare the people for the way of the Lord, in order to prepare the people for the moment. And when the moment comes, Israel is still waiting for the moment. They extend this wine beverage to him, hoping to extend his life so that the fun can last a little bit longer. Finally, Jesus cries out again with a loud voice, and there can be no misunderstanding this cry. He yields his spirit and he breathes his last. My God, why have you forsaken me? When my first daughter was 10 months old, I was putting her to bed one night, and I noticed that she was just shivering and shaking just a little bit. And I thought to myself, is this normal? I haven't seen her do that before. And then I noticed that her little hot little eyes went rolled back up into her head. And then her whole body seized up and was shaking. And I recognized that she was having a seizure. And I was absolutely panicked. I didn't know what was going on. I thought she might be dying. I didn't know. So immediately, I handed Christina to my wife, Karen. I get on the phone. I call 911. The paramedics rush. And by the time they get there, about 10 minutes later or so, the seizure had passed. And they informed us that this is somewhat normal, a seizure, somewhat normal for a 10-month-old to have this kind of experience. Now, I didn't know that. It would have been helpful to know that in advance so that I wouldn't have been panic-stricken over this whole episode. But in that moment, there isn't a thing that I wouldn't have done to save my daughter. I would have gladly, in a split second, given my life for her. Think now about the father. His only son is on the cross. His only son cries out, my God, why have you forsaken me? And this is the father who could have moved heaven and earth to save his son, but he doesn't do it. Something is holding him back. What is that? You know the answer. It's you. It's us. He doesn't rescue his son because he's rescuing us. He forsakes his son so that he doesn't forsake us. He forsakes his son so that we could be reconciled to him. My friends, we are loved way more than we know, and sin is far more destructive than we think. back to the soldiers. Verse 51. And behold, the curtain of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom, and the earth shook, and the rocks were split. The tombs also were opened, and many bodies of the saints who had fallen asleep were raised. And coming out of the tombs after his resurrection, they went into the holy city and appeared to many. When the centurion and those who were with him, keeping watch over Jesus, saw the earthquake and what took place, they were filled with awe and said, "Truly, this was the Son of God." It looks like the Father can't appear on this scene, but he's behind the scenes, groaning with grief too deep for words. He darkens creation for a moment. He shakes the land as if he is convulsing behind the scenes with grief and agony. And he tears the veil of the temple from top to bottom. You go back in the narrative when Jesus was before Caiaphas, the high priest, and Jesus more or less said, "Yes, I am the Christ." What does the high priest do? Tears his robes and says, "Blasphemy." The Father, of course, has no robes to tear. The closest thing he has is this veil in the temple, which clothes his presence in the Holy of Holies. And when his son breathes his last, he tears the veil of the temple, saying in so many words, "Blasphemy? You're the one who's talking blasphemy. This is my son." Jesus predicted the destruction of the temple. It was corrupt. It was no longer needed. The fact that the veil of the temple is torn shows that Jesus' prediction is going to come true. It did come true in 70 AD when the Romans destroyed the temple. And Jesus, of course, is building a whole new temple, one not made of brick and mortar, but flesh and blood. And we are the culmination of that today. We are the temple of the living God. Now, this is one of the most curious things in the Gospels. We have these saints of old, these believers of old, who are raised from the dead. And they walk into the holy city, that's Jerusalem, as a testimony to the people who are there. And we don't know who these people were. We don't know the nature of the resurrection. Was it a permanent resurrection? Was it a resuscitation along the lines of Lazarus, the way Lazarus was raised from the dead? We don't know this. But what we do know, however, is that this whole scene is for a testimony, is for a witness. The Father is validating what's happening here in the crucifixion and the resurrection of his son, saying, "Yes, he really is the Messiah. Believe in him." So the soldiers now say, "Truly, this was the Son of God." Remember, they've been sitting and watching. They're experts at watching men die, but they have never seen a man die like this. How do they mean it? Probably not in the Jewish sense, Son of God, Messiah. Probably more in the Roman sense, because the Roman emperors were called sons of God. So they recognize in Jesus some power, some authority. What all they are talking about, we can't be sure, but they probably are speaking more than they know. At least that's what Matthew wants us to think. Because Jesus, in fact, of course, was the Son of God in the Jewish sense, meaning he's going to be over all creation. Israel was supposed to be the light to the world. And here is Jesus being the light to the world all by himself. As the Roman soldiers, for crying out loud, see something of the truth in Jesus. So we have, in a sense, Elijah being on the scene here. Elijah's name is invoked. We see the specter of Elijah being raised here. Now, if you go back in the Gospel of Matthew, you will recognize that this is not the first time that the specter of Elijah has been raised. You go back to Matthew chapter 3, verse 16, and this is when John the Baptist baptized Jesus, and John the Baptist is identified by Jesus as basically the new Elijah. And when Jesus was baptized, immediately he went up from the water, and behold, the heavens were opened to him, and he saw the Spirit of God descending like a dove and coming to rest on him. And behold, a voice from heaven said, "This is my beloved Son, with whom I am well pleased." So you have the specter of Elijah present, and you have this voice coming out of the heavens. "This is my beloved Son." Move forward, Matthew chapter 17, verse 5. This is the transfiguration. Jesus goes up to the mountain. He takes on a new and different appearance. Appearing with him are Moses and Elijah. Specter of Elijah again. What do we get? He was still speaking when, behold, a bright cloud overshadowed them, and a voice from the cloud said, "This is my beloved Son, with whom I am well pleased." Okay. We get Elijah again, and we get the voice coming out of the heavens. Now, we go to the crucifixion. The Father is holding himself back. He can't appear on the scene. What does he do instead? He sends some Roman pagan soldiers onto the scene, and they are the ones who proclaim, "This is the Son of God." What is the Father doing? He's got to be in total agony. This is not just some, let's do this. Let's do that. This little fireball here, thunderbolt. This is as passionate as it can possibly get. And he can't be there. He's pulled himself back. But he manages to make himself known. And what's he saying through these Roman soldiers? "That's my Son! My God, it's my Son." We have surveyed the wondrous cross. What have we seen? Have we ever seen love like this? You're not going to see it anywhere else but at the cross, the wondrous cross. Love so amazing, so divine, demands my soul, my life, my all. Two more verses, verse 55. "There were also many women there looking on from a distance who had followed Jesus from Galilee ministering to him, among whom were Mary Magdalene and Mary the mother of James and Joseph and the mother of the sons of Zebedee." So these women are looking on. They see the crucifixion. Two of these women were also present when Jesus was placed into the tomb and the stone was rolled against the opening of the tomb. Those same two women also made their way to the tomb on Sunday morning. But that is a story for another day. That is a story for Easter Sunday. So you've got to come back 2 weeks from today. 2 weeks from today, we're going to tell that story. And what you need to do is you need to invite some friends, because I can promise you this: if I am alive, if I'm standing, if I have a voice, they will hear the gospel. And don't, under any circumstances, go on vacation.